From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Some of the biggest policy questions that have swirled around the New Hampshire State House for a long time could be decided in the next few weeks. For years, lawmakers have debated paid family leave, school choice, health care for low-income people, and who should be eligible to vote in this state. Now it's countdown time. We're more than midway through the second half of the legislative session. The bills are getting their final looks and final tweaks, and lawmakers will soon have some choices to make. Today in The Exchange, we sit down with State House and Senate members. They are Jeb Bradley, Republican State Senator from Wolfboro, Senate Majority Leader and Chair of the Health and Human Services Committee. And Senator Bradley, welcome. Good to see you.
Good morning, Laura, and good morning to your listeners.
Also with us, Dan Feltes, Democratic State Senator from Concord. He serves on the Finance Committee and the Ways and Means Committee. Senator Feltes, thank you for taking time out.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, John Hunt, Republican State Representative from Ringe, Chair of the Commerce and Consumer Affairs Committee. And Representative Hunt, thank you for being here.
Good morning.
And also with us, Cindy Rosenwald, Democratic State Rep from Nashua, Deputy Democratic Leader in the House, who serves on the Finance Committee, and Representative Rosenwald. Good to have you, too. Thank you.
Great to be here.
Well, and I want to focus with you all on six issues in particular and invite listener comments on those. They are, you ready? Paid family leave, school choice, victims' rights, child protection, starting off with voter requirements and Medicaid expansion. So those are the topics we're going to cover this hour. Let's get your comments in now so our panel of lawmakers can hear your voice on these issues. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. I want to start off with a bill on who should be eligible to vote and who should not. From what I have read, this was a giant hearing at the State House yesterday, packed in like sardines, according to our reporter. But my big picture question, and I'll start with you, Representative Rosenwald, why does this keep coming up? What's wrong with our voting system that some lawmakers have been seeking to fix?
Well, I don't think there's really anything wrong with our voting system. We are known as having free and fair elections. We really don't have voter fraud. That's a narrative that's been pushed. But there are a couple of bills this year that would seek to change the definition of who is able to vote in New Hampshire. And there's a lot of concern that that would depress the young person and person who moves around a lot vote. Yesterday, there was a very long packed hearing. It had to be moved to a bigger room. A lot of college students came out to testify. They would be required to take certain actions after voting that would cost them money, and they feel it's going to depress their turnout.
So let's dive into this a little bit more. And to you, Senator Bradley, this is the idea, and Representative Rosenwald is alluding to it, defining domicile and resident. College students were out in droves saying this is going to mean we can't vote. What's going on here?
Well, no, it doesn't mean college students or anybody else can't vote. What it says is that if you're going to vote in New Hampshire, we would expect that you would take measures to become a resident of New Hampshire. But nobody is going to be denied the opportunity to vote. We have instituted voter ID. There were a lot of the same arguments that were used opposing voter ID several years ago, but now it is routine. Virtually everybody seems to support it. We want to make sure that people that vote in New Hampshire are able to vote in New Hampshire. And so by saying to somebody who may be temporarily domiciled here, if you're going to vote here, you should take measures to become a resident here. That's all that's being asked of. And I don't think that that's all that difficult to comply with. And again, you'll be able to sign the affidavit that allows you to vote. Nobody will be disenfranchised.
So if I'm a college student from Maine and I go to UNH, how does this affect me?
So you'd be able to vote even if you had a Maine ID. you file the affidavit that says you're domiciled in New Hampshire. What would happen then is after that, there'd be an expectation that you would take measures to become a New Hampshire resident.
Measures
if you're voting
such as,
in New Hampshire.
Measures such as, like, registering your car.
Registering your car,
the vehicle
yeah, in particular.
Fee and so forth. Yeah. I want to get everybody else in on this, too. I didn't mean to cut you off there, Senator Bradley, but lots of people have feelings about this. And as I said, the hearing was packed yesterday. So, Representative Hunt, I think to you next, actually, you had some comments on this bill with the domicile and residency.
Well, I mean, obviously, the critical issue is to make sure you really are legitimate to be voting. And I have actually seen a bus full of people show up on Election Day. It happened several years ago when Barack Obama first ran.
You live in a college town, let's just remind people.
I live in Ringe, and Ringe is a border town. And so, yeah, sure enough, a bus showed up. They were a bunch of Smith College students, and they just got out and held signs for Barack Obama. Now, whether any of them slipped in and decided to vote or not, I'm not saying that, okay? But I'm saying is that when people see that, then there's some question whether something is legitimate. The problem we have is, as a college town, we're a private university. So we're a little bit different than UNH or Plymouth because New Hampshire is the only state in the union that actually charges property tax on dormitories. So these students actually in that dorm are technically residents of New Hampshire. And yes, it is true. We would want them to show that they really want to take that residency and by document it. And the old law years ago was that if you registered that you would then get your driver's license converted or you get your car registered in New Hampshire. So that was always the thought. But like I say, as a town that has a university, we know the problem of all these students that come in on Election Day, and it's always the presidential election where they come in swarms and they all sign up, and no, they don't show up for town meeting day, and or any of the other elections. So it does leave a lot of questions in my constituents' minds, whether they're legitimately should be voting or not.
So you sound a little bit mixed, Representative Hunt. On the one hand, you're saying that students pay property taxes at private schools through their, through their fees and so forth. So maybe they should be treated as residents. On the other hand, you sound concerned that people will come up from Massachusetts in your area, you're close to the border, and try and slip through.
That's exactly right. So that's the balancing act that we're trying to do here. And I do believe that showing your driver's license was a good step. But at the same time, you need to really step up and say, I am a New Hampshire resident. I plan to stay here at the college. My personal feeling is that the student IDs should document what dorm they live in so that we really know that they're really on campus. Or if they're not on campus, then they need to document where off-campus housing they have. But there should be some representation to really show where you live and not just an affidavit in my mind.
Interesting. Okay, Senator Feltes.
Well, unfortunately, this has been a hyper-partisan policy agenda of the Republican majority and control of the State House. Unfortunately, shortly before the election, Governor Sununu was on the Howie Carr radio show saying those Democrats, they're very sly. They bust voters in from Massachusetts on Election Day. That's just false. Then President Trump, about a month later, said up in New Hampshire, they bust people in to New Hampshire to vote on Election Day. And then Governor Sununu was asked, where did that come from? Well, it came from his comments. So
I think he's pulled back on those comments.
He has, thankfully, but it doesn't reflect well in New Hampshire. It doesn't reflect well on our poll workers, on our election officials who won good, clean elections. And that's the underlying myth that's driving this bill. And my friend Senator Bradley said, all the bills do is require you to take measures. Well, those measures of registering a car, getting a driver's license cost money, and that constitutes, in many people's view, an unconstitutional poll tax on voting in the state of New Hampshire. And we ought to be doing everything we can to include people in our democracy, young people, seniors who may not have a car or driver's license. And it's about attracting and retaining people here in the state of New Hampshire, not setting up barriers that may disenfranchise people from participating in democracy. Let's focus on the real problems. Let's work together in a bipartisan way. Let's not pursue a hyper-partisan agenda. I think we've made progress on a lot of issues working together. This is one that has consumed a lot of time and a lot of effort that shouldn't have. We have a great democracy in the state of New Hampshire, and this doesn't reflect well on it.
Let's take some calls, all of you. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. First off, with our lawmakers, we're talking about voter requirements and another bill that attempts to clear up confusion around domicile and resident. That's what supporters say. So we're talking about voting requirements. A little bit later, we'll talk about Medicaid expansion and then turn to school choice and some other topics. But let's hear from you now. Again, email is exchange@nhpr.org. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Charlie's calling in from Derry. Hi, Charlie. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Good morning.
Morning.
I have a couple of related questions. One is, where can Senator Bradley tell us that other states have similar requirements to that suggest, as this apparently this proposal does, to that that voters have to say that they intend to live in New Hampshire indefinitely? What about college students? What about military? What about just people that are changing jobs? Where on earth is anybody required to say, in order to vote, that they intend to live in New Hampshire indefinitely?
Well, Charlie, thank you for the call. Senator Bradley, go ahead.
Yeah, and my understanding is that many other states have this kind of requirement that New Hampshire would not be unusual. And, you know, when my friend Senator Feltz talks about hyperpartisan, this is not hyperpartisan. One of the most respected people in the State House, our Secretary of State, Bill Gardner, who's defended the New Hampshire primary for years and years and years, who's a registered Democrat, has come out in support of these bills because he does believe that there are questions that get raised and that we need to have things like voter ID and make sure that people who vote in New Hampshire are eligible to vote in New Hampshire. So, you know, if there's any hyperpartisanness, it's the people attacking these reforms that make sense, because I think people want to make sure that we do have clean elections. And Bill Gardner, as I said, one of the most respected people in the State House, is supporting this.
Well, NHPR's Casey McDermott, as you probably know, Senator Bradley, has done some pretty in-depth reporting on voter fraud. She combed through all the files. She got all sorts of documentation from the Secretary of State's office and concluded that it's pretty darn rare, in fact, exceedingly rare. So I just wonder what you think about that. People worry about it, but when you look at the actual documentation, the evidence, it's not that much there.
Well, as I recall, and I'm just, you know, off the top of my head, during the last presidential primary, two Bernie Sanders campaign workers used his office as their domicile when they registered to vote. Vice President Joe Biden's niece voted in New Hampshire when she was really living elsewhere. So,
that's a concern, not just college students, but campaign workers who might come in.
You know, I think overall, generally speaking, yeah, we do do a pretty good job of clean elections. But, you know, we heard the same arguments about requiring a piece of identification when you went into the polls to vote. And that hasn't disenfranchised anybody.
Go ahead, Senator Feltus, and then I've got another caller up.
Well, again, the big distinction here is this is well beyond voter ID. This is requiring people to take measures, as Senator Bradley put it, to establish permanent residency, including potentially registering your car, which costs money, getting a driver's license, which costs money. A lot of young people, college students, may not have a car. They may not have a driver's license in the state of New Hampshire. Senior citizens may not have cars, may not have driver's license. That is going to deter and constitute an unconstitutional poll tax on young people and seniors. I got to tell you, it was inspiring to see hundreds of young people show up yesterday, just like hundreds of young people are standing up and speaking out on gun control. They're getting active in our democracy. They want to protect their rights in our democracy. And it was great to see them at the State House having their voice heard.
Well, Senator Birdsell, the sponsor of this, said yesterday, Democrats and out-of-state organizations have developed and are promoting an untrue narrative that is disenfranchising voters, specifically college students in the Granite State. Senator Birdsell said, quote, despite their claims, the bill heard today does not disenfranchise college students. Period. Let's take another caller on this. Rick is calling from Vermont. Yeah.
One thing, Laura.
Sure.
Massachusetts, Maine, and Vermont have the same laws as what's being proposed in New Hampshire. So, I mean, this isn't the radical type of thing that others are calling it. It's common sense, and states around us do it.
Well, speaking of surrounding states, let's take a call from Rick in Vermont. And go ahead, Rick, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thank you very much. I'm grateful for the discussion, but I think it's a little overboard. In Vermont, you have to register in advance of your session or your time to vote. So why do I need an ID to present when I'm on a list already to check off as I go through the process? And once I complete my vote, I'm then checked again to be sure that they've got it right. I don't need an ID. If I have a driver's license, I'm happy to present it. But why make people go out to get another ID when you have to register to vote to begin with? That's my thing.
So clarification, Rick, should happen at the registration level. That seems to be what he's saying, Representative Rosenwald.
That's my understanding of what he said. Just point out that New Hampshire has same-day registration, unlike a number of other states. But I'd also like to make the point that many college students in New Hampshire spend more time in our state than people who go away for the winter, who may be gone from
snowbirds.
Yeah, November until through April. If they're smart this year, they'll probably stay away until May.
Representative Hunt, I can see you want to jump in. Go ahead.
I think that at the end of the day, this is not in terms of making it more difficult to vote. It is about the integrity of our vote. And I think this is what Bill Gardner also emphasized, which is you can't, you know, how many people we can have, any evidence or all this. That's not the point. The point is we want to reassure everyone that the integrity of our vote here in New Hampshire is the best it possibly can be.
So what's a good compromise? Again, given that you're from a college town, what's a good way to make sure that, you know, young people feel like they can participate in our democracy, but that you don't have concerns like Senator Bradley mentioned, you know, campaign workers sneaking into vote or college students who don't really live here? I mean, what's the middle ground here?
Well, see, that's the problem I have with this, is that yes, in New Hampshire, we're very fortunate that we have same-day registration. I actually remember voting for that because we didn't want to have to force the town clerks to have to register everybody, and we made a conscientious decision to vote for it, and there was quite a debate about it because we actually did it retroactively, and there was some pushback on that. But at the end of the day, for me, in terms of the students, you know, both my all my kids, when they lived in Colorado and Massachusetts, they all got their driver's license in those states. It was not a big deal. It was an appropriate thing for them to do, which is that if you're going to school there, you know, and I urge them to get involved in the local politics, to get to know what's going on in their communities. And the best way to do that is to get a driver's license and get your car registered and really feel connected to your community. And not just say, okay, I'm just here. I just want to vote for the presidential election and then be gone. And don't worry, I won't get muddled up in all the other things that politics of the state. But that's not right. If you are going to college here, then you need to show a commitment that you really want to be here.
Small point of fact, what about students who don't have cars? I didn't have a car when I was in college.
Okay. Well, it's easy to get an ID, I know, because I got it from my mother when she was not driving anymore. You just go right up to the registry, and all they ask for is anything. As a matter of fact, because she was living in a nursing home, I actually had the Episcopal Church newsletter that had her name on it with the address, and they took that.
Senator Felt is super quick.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, everybody on the show this morning have worked to find middle ground on a lot of pieces of legislation. I don't think there's a middle ground on an unconstitutional poll tax, to be quite frank. And I think if there is middle ground, it's on things like modern reforms like online voter registration and improving the system's secure and modern voting system, which I think we can do working together.
Well, coming up after a break, we're going to talk about something else where there is middle ground, and that's Medicaid expansion. Then we'll turn to another less middle ground-ish, if I could call it that, topic, and that's education freedom savings accounts, the school choice bill that's been circulating for a while. So we'll talk about those two coming up. You can join us as well. Thanks for the people who called. 1-800-892-6477.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, several longstanding policy debates could be decided soon at the New Hampshire State House. This hour, we're sitting down with a panel of lawmakers, catching up on six key issues. We've already talked about voter requirements. We'll talk in just a moment about Medicaid expansion and school choice. Other issues we're going to cover: paid family leave, a victims' rights effort called Marcy's Law. All that we'll be talking about this hour. And we'd love to take your calls, questions, and concerns, especially right now on Medicaid expansion and school choice. You can join us with an email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our panel includes John Hunt, a Republican state representative from Ringe, Jeb Bradley, a Republican state senator from Wolfboro, and the majority leader in the Senate. Dan Feltes is here, a Democrat from Concord, and Cindy Rosenwald, a Democrat from Nashua. Again, our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. And let's talk about Medicaid expansion. And Senator Bradley, I do want to start this off with you, because you've been really kind of leading the effort to find common ground on this issue. Just to set it up a little bit, Medicaid expansion is set to expire at the end of this year unless reauthorized. The proposal now in play, called New Hampshire Granted Advantage, would extend Medicaid for 5 years. I think the question now at this point, correct me if I'm wrong, Senator Bradley, is how do we pay for it?
Well, first of all, I think this has been a teamwork effort, bipartisan. It's had the support of Republicans and Democrats in the legislature. It's supported by Governor Sununu. A lot of great leadership coming from the governor's office on this issue. And it continues a successful program that's helped 50,000 people have access to health insurance other than just walking into the emergency room, which is the most expensive care available. And so that's led to a healthier workforce. It's reduced uncompensated care. Yes, so we do have to pay for it now. We've had funding sources for a smaller state share in the past. Funding from the high-risk pool, as well as the premium tax on Medicaid expansion policies. Now we're going to, for the first time in a long, long time, fully fund the, or use 5% of the liquor fund, which advocates against substance abuse have been talking about for years, to also fund the state share. So we do have a stable funding source. That's a reason for the five-year authorization, which will have the benefit, especially when we are dealing with the opioid crisis and the mental health crisis, increasing capacity to help us deal as a state with those two terrible issues.
So is that enough, the liquor fund, for to fund this for 5 years? Because I'm thinking 50,000 Granite Staters, that's, you know, a lot of expensive coverage.
We believe so, and that's one of the reasons we're moving from what's known as premium assistance or private insurance policies paid for through Medicaid funds to a managed care type of provider, which will be lower cost, but not only lower cost, better care coordination and prevention. And so by creating incentives for people to get the appropriate level of care, we're going to have cost savings in the program too. So that helps us with paying the state share of this.
Well, Representative Rosenwald, you're on the House Finance Committee, and I know there have been some questions about, you know, the shifting pots of money. How do you feel about the way that New Hampshire has chosen to pay for this?
Well, I think it's an interesting and creative approach, because our statutory requirement has been no general funds. And indeed, the alcohol funds are not general funds. However, opponents have said, oh, but they're state funds. So that's still a problem. There was last week an announcement that the hospitals had agreed to pay for what had been paid for by the alcohol fund.
Yeah, that's what I mean by shifting pots of money. Yeah.
Shifting pots of money, not to get wonkish.
That's
on
okay.
This,
you're on the finance committee.
But the money that has paid for the governor's commission on drug and alcohol prevention, treatment, and recovery has paid for some services that are not Medicaid services. I think we're going to have to see how that works out under this new scenario.
Do you think this will fly with Democrats and Republicans in the House? I think the Senate's more kind of on board with this.
I think there are some concerns from Democrats about the sustainability beyond the current biennium, but I'm comfortable with it.
Representative Hunt, how comfortable are you with this?
Well, that's the sustainability is the heart of the issue, and that is that for me, I've always voted against the Medicaid expansion because I never thought it was sustainable from the get-go. And each year, you know, we got, you know, with the shell game, we can call it whatever, something else. But, you know, I mean, last year we had the hospitals donate the money, and then we found out, well, I can't do that. That's illegal. So now we'll just use the liquor fund. And yet we have pressures on you know, liquor in terms of its revenue and maintaining its revenue and sustaining it. It's an important revenue to the state. And, you know, whatever, yes, it is true, we allocate some money and say we want to be using this for alcohol treatment. But that was legislatively done. It was never really funded until now when we say, oh, well, now we have a place where we can move this money and feel good about it. So Medicaid expansion has the work requirement. That's good.
So you like that part, but you are concerned about the sustainability.
It's always been sustainable. You know, right out of the block, the Fed said that you know, that at some point in time, this is going to get reduced. And just remind everybody that you know when it comes to you know, the federal government, they only pay 50%. So at some point in time, it's 90 now, but you know, at some point in time, the pressure will be to take this group and move them down to the same Medicaid that everybody's in, which is only 50%.
So is it worth finding a sustainable source, Representative Hunt, in your mind, or should we just give up on this
aspect
of Obamacare?
I'm not looking for a new tax, no. No, I'm not looking for, you know, new types, but I understand, you know, that we're, you know, to me, it's Medicaid is on, you know, we're going to keep trying each year to try to find a solution. But, you know, it's not unusual. I've been around a long time. I was around for the creation of the bed tax, you know, and again, you know, these are the big beneficiary of all of this is obviously the hospitals because of the uncompensated care. So, you know, it's a balancing act that we have. And we'll keep each session, we'll come up with something. But myself personally, I would not be able to vote for it.
Well, and Senator Rosenwald, Representative Rosenwald, I see you want to jump in. But Senator Feltes, to you first, please, what about the work requirement? How do Democrats in the Senate feel about that?
Well, again, we worked with our Republican colleagues, Senator Bradley, Senator Morris, appreciate their leadership on this, along with Representative Rosenwald. We worked on this issue and made the work requirement a New Hampshire work requirement, making it New Hampshire. That's what we wanted to do all along, is make this work for New Hampshire. I think a lot of people compromised and we came up with a reasonable plan and a reasonable plan overall. And really at the end of the day, what you're talking about is 50,000 Granite Staters, their health insurance. We can't pull the rug out from underneath them. We can't cut care or cut people off of the program and put in benchmarks and assurances that we can keep it moving forward in a reasonable way, which is, again, as Senator Bradley mentioned, the single most effective way to combat our heroin and opioid public health crisis. We got to get it done.
So you don't love the work requirement, but it's all right.
At no piece of legislation, Laura, is perfect. I would say that this
really?
Is...
Really?
And as my friend Senator Bradley always says, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. I believe that we've come up with a reasonable design, and my fear moving forward is if folks, tinker with it quite a bit, you may end up losing votes, and we can't lose votes. We got to get this done.
Representative Rosenwald, and then we're going to wrap this Medicaid discussion up and move on to school choice. Go ahead, Representative Rosenwald.
Well, I just want us to not lose sight of the fact that the Medicaid expansion is an economic stimulus, in my opinion. Hospitals in New Hampshire, half of which are in smaller rural communities, are often the largest employer in those cities and towns. And we're talking about this year, I think, $450 million invested into the New Hampshire healthcare system, freeing up money for New Hampshire people to be able to spend elsewhere in the economy.
That's so, the money that comes in from the federal government.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, from voting rights, Medicaid expansion to school choice and what are called education freedom savings accounts. And we also want you to jump into our conversation. Your questions and comments are always welcome. Exchange@nhpr.org. Exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter, of course. That's NHPR Exchange. Barbara just had a comment on Facebook. She says, I stood outside the State House today and admired how simple it is to be engaged in our legislative process. Walk in, listen, get involved, find your voice, make a difference. Barbara, thank you for the comment. You can comment on Facebook, too, like Barbara did. Again, it's NHPR Exchange. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So another bill that has gotten tons and tons of attention, as you all know, this is SB 193, allowing parents to access the state portion of their child's school adequacy grant, roughly $3,000, use that for alternative education. This bill has bumped up against philosophical and financial questions. And what are those, Senator Feltes? I'll go to you first, but want to hear from everybody.
Well, I think the fundamental premise is that public tax dollars shouldn't be used to subsidize private prep schools and private religious schools. And in fact, there's a provision of the New Hampshire Constitution that says it with respect to religious schools. So I think that is the fundamental objection. And then you look at the estimates, which range in tens of millions of dollars that could be drained away from supporting public education. At the end of the day, what we need to be doing is helping local property taxpayers afford public education in their communities. This will just result in property taxes going up, middle-class Granite Staters. At the end of the day, we need a system that works. Let's get together and work on enhancing public education, not undermining it.
Well, supporters of this bill, and I'm sure you know Senator Feltes, say, look, if a child leaves, his or her state dollars do go with them, you know, the $3,000-ish. But the school would still get the local money associated with that student. That could be a lot more than the state grant. I've heard, you know, $7,000. Plus, the school wouldn't have to educate that child. So in that analysis, this is kind of a win for the school.
I think
students are no longer there, but you still have that, you know, that local share.
I think it's not as straightforward as that comment has respectfully. But, you know, look, at the end of the day, this is going to be about whether or not you believe that public tax dollars should go to subsidize private prep schools and private religious schools. And I think this is something that there is a fundamental disagreement within some of the folks on this panel about. But at the end of the day, I think we got to support public education and support expanding opportunities for everyone, not just those at the top.
What do you think, Representative Hunt? These are public tax dollars associated with certain values and accountability measures and so forth. So should those go to private schools?
I've been to this debate before. Uh-huh. I am the godfather of charter schools in New Hampshire. I wrote the original law with Jim Rubens and then did the follow-up law that now enables school districts to, the charter schools to apply directly without bypassing the school district. To me, the issue is, has always been, that in education is that we want parents and students to choose the school. We want to empower them that they're there because they want to be there. How many times have I heard teachers say, you know, that the kids and the parents don't care? They're not motivated. They feel like they're here because they have to be here, not because they want to be here. And to me, that's what we're trying to change here. And the same thing with charter schools was to try to create new schools and new environments that is attractive for people want to go there, want to be there. And it's that buy-in that we're looking for. And I think a voucher, if we want to call it a voucher plan or whatever, the school, and we're limiting now only to, you know, people with certain neck, but we should be doing this for every student. They should be showing that they're at that school because they want to be there. And this is a good way to show that representation with bringing the monies with them.
There's been an accountability question raised, Representative Hunt, as I'm sure you know, whether the recipient educators are qualified, certified, whether kids with special needs would be welcome. The public has decided through the public system that these values are important. So they would ask, opponents of this say, hey, why should public tax dollars go to schools that might not uphold those values?
Well, they do now because the charter schools do not require that every teacher be a certified teacher. They only require 50%. So, I mean, if they're going to use that argument, they got, you know, forget that we've already done this. We've already said that, you know, the money is not about who's going, you know, the state standards and who are going to grade the school. This is about people wanting to be there, that we want the students to be enabled and empowered. They're saying, I'm here because I want, and now I'm ready to learn and not be distracted by other issues.
This has been a very controversial bill. And I wonder, Representative Rosenwald, how do you think it's going to go?
Well, it just got delayed again yesterday for two more weeks.
Because of the financing of it?
I'm not privy to why it got delayed again. My guess is that the votes weren't there to pass it in committee. It's been sitting in the Finance Committee since the beginning of February, I think. And here it is now, the middle of April. So it's just hasn't been moving. But I think that the concerns about this bill range from more values-oriented, the constitutional question about using public funds laundered in a way to support religious schools and private schools and homeschool also, to a concern of mine, which is the downshift that's going to make people's property taxes higher. When I've looked at the estimates, the range of what could happen in my city of Nashua, the impact over a few years could be into the millions of dollars.
As those state adequacy dollars go elsewhere. Although, what do you think about that financial argument that supporters of this have made, that, look, the school still gets the local money, and that's a good chunk of change, and the kid's not even there?
However, those costs that go away with kids who leave the public schools are not the full cost. It doesn't include overhead. It doesn't include expensive students who might have disabilities or other reasons why it costs more to educate them. So in a bigger city and town like Nashua, the children are not all in the same place. We have a number of elementary schools. We have 3 middle schools and 2 high schools. So if kids are leaving a little bit from here and a little bit from there, it doesn't really significantly lower the cost to run that school system.
Senator Bradley, I haven't heard from you yet on this.
Well, thank you, Laura. You know, as a father of 4 kids, I can attest to my own experience, public schools in New Hampshire are good. They are good. That doesn't mean that every square peg can fit into a round hole, and every student is different, and the needs of every student are different. And so choices like John's leadership on charter schools or homeschooling or the opportunity for lower-income New Hampshire residents to have the same choices in where to educate their children as higher income people already have because of higher income, I think is very, very important. And this bill, as you correctly note, Laura, has protected the property taxpayers in local districts by allowing them to keep the local dollars without the responsibility of educating the kids that make a choice. And it's, in all likelihood, going to be a very small universe of kids that actually choose this option.
Because they've limited the number of families that would be eligible.
Yes.
All right. I know other people want to jump in on this, but we're heading into a break. And I did want to pick up after the break a couple other topics, including paid family leave, New Hampshire's child protection system, and then Marcy's Law. So all that's coming up. It's an ambitious schedule, but I think we can get through it. And we'll keep taking your comments, too. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, a tough conversation about race and tolerance in the Oyster River community in the Durham area. Join us for that tomorrow on The Exchange. This hour, we're looking at 6 major debates in the legislature and how they might be resolved. We're sitting down with a panel of 2 Democrats, 2 Republicans, 2 senators, 2 House members, and covering a lot of ground. We're going to turn to 3 more bills in this segment of our show: New Hampshire's child protection system, paid family leave, and Marcy's Law. As always, let's hear from you on these. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And all of you, I did want to talk briefly at least about, something we've done so many programs on here in The Exchange, and that's New Hampshire's child protection system. This has been a bipartisan effort this year after some pretty terrible episodes of child abuse, even death, came to light concerning kids and families supposedly under the watch of the Division of Children, Youth, and Families. It even hurts to say those words. Senator Bradley, what does this agency need, and is it going to get it from the State House this year?
Well, first of all, I think the fact that we got into the problems that we've gotten into has been a bipartisan failure in the past. Both Republicans and Democrats didn't adequately fund child protection. And now we've, as you correctly note, seen some very high-profile cases of abuse and neglect and death. And so there's a recognition in the legislature that we have to rebuild the number of caseworkers that deal with child protection, caseworkers that deal with foster parents. We need to fund services for families at risk, and all of which has started in the last budget. Governor Sununu called for funding 20 new caseworker positions. Senator Feltz and I, and I believe Representative Rosenwald, have sponsored or co-sponsored or worked on three bills, Senate Bill 582, 590, and 592, all of which deal with more caseworkers and more dollars for these voluntary services to try to stem off the problems of abuse and neglect. And I think that, you know, those bills sailed through the Senate. Not everybody got everything they wanted, but an awful lot of new resources will go into it. The House is working on them diligently, and I think that Representative Rosenwald's committee is going to come out with a good final product. And I think this is a problem that has been long in the creation. It's not going to get solved overnight, but I think we are taking significant measures to protect our most vulnerable people in New Hampshire, our kids.
Including the funding, there was a whole special report on this, an outside reviewer and so forth. And one of the other things they found, Senator Bradley, I know you know this, is not just the overwhelmed agency, not enough staff to keep track, but there were rules in place that child protection workers felt, you know, kind of tied their hands. In some instances, they wanted to go in, but there were certain rules because people were concerned about privacy. People were concerned about the state stepping in and, quote unquote, taking their kids away. And I wonder if those rules are going to change and give the workers more ability to track.
Well, we've already started that process of changing those rules, because in the past, you either had to have a founded concern or essentially no concern. Yeah. So you had to have a pretty high threshold. And so we've created a new class of unfounded but with reasonable concern. And it's kind of like the old saying where there's, you know, smoke, there could be fire. And so if there are a collection of complaints that haven't risen to the level of unfounded, but they're starting to accumulate, that's when these voluntary services will come in. There's more record retention, another bill that Senator Carson filed. These are all systemic problems. I think we have overreacted to some pretty high-profile cases in the past where maybe parental rights were violated, and I think maybe we went a little bit too far in that direction and didn't adequately protect kids. I think now we're starting to see the results of that with some of the high-profile, terrible cases that we've had, and recognizing that kids have to be the first priority, their safety. And sometimes, unfortunately, that means they have to be removed from the parental household.
Well, it's tragic. And so you're saying before Senator Bradley, we had two categories. Yes, there's a problem. No, there isn't. Now we have a maybe category.
Somebody in the press, you put it about as well as it could be put, Laura.
That's why they pay me the big bucks. Go ahead, Representative Rosenwald.
Well, I was going to just add that it was a major change for us to make it the public policy that the child's safety is the primary concern driving all of our efforts. And I think that was huge.
Did you want to jump in, Senator Feltus?
I'll just say that there's no more important thing that we can do as a government than protect our children, especially our vulnerable children. And as a new dad, Iris is coming up on 8 months.
Congratulations,
thank
by
you
the way.
Very much.
She's adorable.
This is something that's especially poignant to me, and I really appreciate all the bipartisan cooperation this year. Obviously, last year, a part of the reason I voted against the budget and have been very public about that is because I believe that Governor Sununu's budget was deficient on child protection. But we are taking steps this year in a bipartisan way to correct that and move forward together, and I think that's important.
Thoughts from you, Representative Hunt?
I agree.
Okay. All right. Senator Bradley, I know you have to head back to the State House. You've got a lot to do, so we will finish out our two other topics, paid family leave and Marcy's Law, without you. Thank you very much for your time today. We
thank you very
appreciate
much,
it.
Lauren. Thank you to all your listeners.
That's Senator Jeb Bradley, Republican from Wolfboro, Senate Majority Leader, Chair of the Health and Human Services Committee. We've still got time to take your questions and comments. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So let's tackle another bill that has received a lot of support, but some pushback. This is called Marcy's Law, to put a constitutional amendment in New Hampshire's Constitution. Supporters say this would enhance victims' rights, give victims a larger voice in court proceedings, or as one put it, put a voice and a seat at the table. Representative Hunt, how do you feel about this Marcy's Law constitutional amendment effort?
Well, I'm just getting up to speed on it, obviously, because it came over from the Senate. I have mixed emotions. I certainly, don't have a problem passing a constitutional amendment. But generally, I've never had an opportunity where a constitutional amendment was so far-reaching, so expansive. The ones, like I think in the past, we dealt with the election of state representatives, much more getting right down to the nitty-gritty, into the detail, and then which I can get my arms around of. So I'm a little concerned after hearing the judge point out yesterday that When does it kick in? Does it kick in after the person has been found guilty? Doesn't sound like it. That's not what I hear in the public testimony. I hear that they were worried about the arrest that happened weeks just before they bumped into him into a store. And so obviously that sort of sounds like you're guilty before proven innocent. And so I'm a little concerned about that. I know that a constitutional amendment is I've been through several constitutional debates, and usually it comes down to, well, just pass it and let the voters decide. Don't weigh in. You should just give the constituents the opportunity to weigh in. But I'd still have to think of myself then would I be voting for it as a constituent versus a legislator? And so I'm still listening.
Well, I'm glad you reminded us that this, correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, it passed the Senate. And now it's before you guys in the House, and so you're taking a look at it, and you need to kind of really think about it. It's a big deal.
Yes, that's correct.
Well, and you referenced the judge, and there was a hearing, big hearing on this yesterday, and former state Supreme Court Justice Carol Ann Conboy warned the amendment could undermine due process. I'm quoting from Jason Moon's reporting here at NHPR. In part, she said, by recognizing someone as a victim before the trial has taken place, Judge Conboy said, until that other person is legally proven to be responsible for the crime, the victim is, in fact, and law, only an alleged victim. And as you said, Representative Hunt, this did pass by a wide margin in the Senate last month. How did you vote, Senator Feltus, on this?
Well, at the beginning, I said we need to make this New Hampshire. This is not supposed to be about a national campaign or an out-of-state billionaire. It's supposed to be about our Constitution and what we want to be in our Constitution. Substantial improvements, in my view, were made in the Senate, more closely aligning it with the Victims' Bill of Rights statute, dealing with some of the due process concerns, and dealing with the depositions and interview issues, among others. And for those reasons, I voted yes. And so, look, it is deserving. It's a constitutional amendment. So
that's a big deal.
It's a big deal. And we had a three-hour debate in the Senate. It was a vigorous hearing. It was vigorous debate and discussion. And I expect the House will undergo a vigorous debate and discussion, too. And it deserves it.
How do you feel about it, Senator? Representative Rosenwald.
Well, I think Representative Hunt nailed it. This is a huge constitutional amendment. I think a lot of House members probably haven't made up their minds.
Sure, yet. Fair enough.
The House often does the heavy policy lifting because there are more of us. I mean,
well,
honestly,
Senator Bradley's gone now, so you can say
right,
that.
But right. There are so many of us. It's in the possession of two very good committees, and I think a lot of House members are probably saying, I don't need to prejudge this. Let's see what it is when it comes out of those committees.
So you're going to take your amended time on it.
Again, I think a lot of House members are going to take their time.
I think the biggest thing I've heard is people say is, can we solve some of these things just legislatively? I mean, what are the things that the Constitution is not, you know, what are we not getting? Can we solve it legislatively rather than taking this huge step by doing a constitutional
amendment? Yeah, and that's a question that came up on our show on this. People who were worried about Marcy's Law said, look, we've already got some of these rights enshrined in law and in practice, so maybe we just need to beef up the court system so that they have the resources
and then,
to
And then, of course,
do
does
that.
It conflict with 28A, an unfunded mandate to communities? Are we going to decide which constitutional amendment trumps?
All right. Well, let's take a call on this. Taylor wants to jump in from Concord. Hi, Taylor. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. So I actually sat through all 7 hours of testimony yesterday.
Wow, Taylor.
Yeah, it was a lot. But what I took away from that, I mean, is that the bottom line is that there are victims in New Hampshire that the criminal justice system fails, and something is obviously needed to help these victims. And based on what I saw yesterday, I mean, lots of people want to point out everything that they think is wrong with Marcy's Law. But it doesn't seem to me that people who oppose this or have, you know, issues with it really want to sit down and work this out and respond to the victims in New Hampshire, you know, that need the legislature's help. And what shocked me yesterday is that somebody said that a constitutional amendment has been considered in New Hampshire since 1993. But we have nothing in our Constitution. We don't even have a single word about victims.
What do you think is missing, Taylor? That's the question I think our two House members are wrestling with. What's missing?
I think what's missing is an effort on the legislature's part to really sit down and work this out and say to victims, you know, we hear that there are issues and that we want to work on this to give you something that tells you that we understand that you are going through something very difficult and we don't want the criminal justice system to fail you. And so we need to, I think, elevate the rights to the Constitution. And I just want to know for everyone on the show, I mean, are you guys willing to sit down with everyone and really work this out and give something to the victims that are failed by our system?
If not Marcy's Law, then what else do you have to offer? Taylor, thank you so much. Go ahead, Representative Hunt.
Yeah, I guess the question is, even if you pass the constitutional amendment, you haven't still done anything yet. You know, and what is the actual thing that we need to do? What law do we need to pass? You know, laws certainly get their authority from the Constitution. And so you can say, well, we're passing this law because the Constitution requires us to do this. But at the end of the day, let's get into what are the places where we are dropping the ball and where we need to do more, because a constitutional amendment it's a good idea. It doesn't actually say how you're going to implement it.
Well, thank you for the call, Taylor. And I got a couple emails here, too. Here's one. My name is Paula. I am a survivor of childhood sexual abuse. Yesterday, I testified in support of Marcy's Law because I believe victims of crime deserve a voice in the criminal justice system. While New Hampshire has a victim's bill of rights in statute, so that's partly what we've been talking about here, I heard many instances of those statutory rights being disregarded and with no path of recourse for the victims. Paula says it's clear to me that the only way to guarantee an equitable criminal justice system is to enshrine victims' rights in our state constitution. So she's agreeing with you, Taylor. And I wonder what you think, Representative Rosenwald, first of all.
Well, I'm a member of the Finance Committee, so I often think that lofty goals are good, but if we're not willing to fund programs, we haven't really met our goals.
So this would make us feel good, but there needs to be dollars to back up the promises of this. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, really. I mean, we can pass all the laws, we can pass all the constitutional amendments we want, but we need to put our money where our mouth is.
Well, here's an email that came in from someone who did not want his or her name used. This is of grave concern, this person says. Having had a family member in court for a situation based on, quote, recovered dreams, I know all too well that there is very little that can be done to guard against false claims. The court case regarding admissibility of these charges took months, costly expert witnesses, great emotional toll. A ruling found that the basis for the charges was only the dreams, and that since they were the, quote, evidence, the charges were finally dropped. The case never went to trial, but the damage has been done. This person says Marcy's Law could affect every bus driver, teacher, any of us who works with children. We have laws that protect victims. We have victim advocates. This person says baseless charges can be made and bring financial ruin. So we've done a whole show on Marcy's Law, sounding like we're going to have to look at this again on the exchange. Very quickly, Senator Feltus, I wanted to ask you about something I know that's near and dear to your heart, and that's paid family leave. We're running out of time, but I did want to allow you the opportunity to just give us an update.
Sure. I think if for the listeners out there who understand how important this is to our economy, to working families, to worker retention and productivity, having some temporary wage replacement insurance if you have a new child, if, God forbid, you have a spouse who may be ill or potentially passing away, or a child perhaps with disabilities, some temporary wage replacement insurance so that people don't have to choose between work and family. We value work, we value family, we value the proposition. You shouldn't have to choose between the two if at all possible. So reach out to your state senators. Reach out to my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, Republicans. It's been bipartisan all the way. It's in the state Senate. It's House Bill 628. So reach out. Have your voice heard. Let's get paid family finally done after years and years of study and analysis and research. Let's get it done.
Well, and I know we did a whole program on this, and everybody agrees with the goal, but the financing is tricky for folks.
That's not true.
That's what I've heard. Yeah.
No state has ever done it this way. Other states, the employer pays for it. Yeah. No, the idea of how the employee pay for it needs to have actuarial study.
There already
this
is a study.
Never been studied.
They've all been
done. The only study has been done is by the employment security.
Studies have been done.
And that's not their task.
Well, this is so great. We get to talk about this again on the exchange. Thank you all. Come back. It was really good to have you. I really appreciate you taking the time. I know it's a busy season over there at State House. Thank you so much.
Laura.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.